Welcome into Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. A special shout out to our Studio Tubers today on YouTube, because the topic of today's show is
YouTube.
YouTube itself. 20 years ago, trio of folks registered the domain name YouTube.com. And Cherry, I think they're going to make it.
Yeah. They're doing pretty good here.
Just to give you a sense of how dominant YouTube has become, I was prepping for the show today. And I told you three guys registered this domain name 20 years ago. One of them, by the way, is from Reading, Pennsylvania. That's an aside.
Always a connection.
Yeah, there's always something. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But one of them's name is Javed Karim. His name is spelled first name J-A-W-E-D, but it's pronounced a little differently than it looks. So what do I do when I need to find out the pronunciation of someone's name, which I have to do all the time in this job?
Go to YouTube.
I go to YouTube. It really has become indispensable for all sorts of things, that type of research, instructional videos. It gets lumped in with Facebook and X and other social media platforms, but in some ways it's more like Google Maps, because you genuinely need it to do certain things, and it has also that entertainment and community value.
Yeah.
It's really changed the world in so many ways. We're going to talk about it today in our main segments. Our question for you: how has YouTube changed the way you use media, and how has it changed our culture? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. And
if you're on YouTube,
yes.
Make sure you leave your question or comment in the chat. And
that's,
you know,
right.
You know, this show, I was excited about this show because I use YouTube for so many things. Like recipes, product endorsements, right? Hair, like how to do hairstyles, makeup, right? I learned how to do a cat eye watching YouTube videos. Yeah. So it's become a repository
for
videos.
Cat eye? How is
it's pretty
cat
good. I've become an expert cat eye. Thank
I literally
you very much.
Just chatted on the YouTube channel right now.
Hey.
Just as you were doing that. I mean, that's how seamless it is. Anyways, so we're going to talk about YouTube today again. 888-477-9499, studio2@whyy.org. Very excited for that conversation. But first, a trio of local news stories. You're starting us off today, Cherry.
I am. President Trump, as you know, has rolled back funding for DEI programs, but Montgomery County is doubling down. They are opting to expand their Office of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. The county's Board of Commissioners voted along party lines to spend about $500,000 to hire 4 new staff members to work under the DEI office chief, including the county's first director of immigrant affairs. The office was founded back in 2001, and its purpose has been to facilitate a diverse workforce and culture of inclusion. It had been staffed by just 1 person. Now they'll have 5 people working there. Democratic County Commissioners Jamila Winder and Neil Makija both have expressed approval of this effort, and their goal is to simply reinforce the Democratic-led commitment to DEI. Now, Republicans, as you know, have been very critical of DEI. They see it as discriminatory, you know, against white people and straight men. And President Donald Trump, on day one, issued an executive order eliminating DEI from the federal government and halting funding for programs and initiatives, Avi.
Yeah, interesting story from the Inquirer about all of this. One of the interesting things was that the commissioners themselves did not do an interview.
No.
So they're doing it, right? But my read on that is they're not actually actively trying to draw attention to it in this climate. So I think there is some, you know, whether it's this issue or any other issue where the administration has taken a really strong stance, there's, I think, a desire from folks on the other side of that issue to move forward with the work, but not necessarily a desire to pick a fight.
Yeah. Yeah. Because right now it's still unclear what folks are, what is illegal, what's not illegal. And Trump has encouraged, you know, folks to go after DEI friendly businesses. And we've seen, you know, companies roll back DEI initiatives.
Google.
Amazon, Google. Yeah.
Which owns YouTube.
Exactly. Yeah. And so Target.
Alphabet, yeah.
So many companies, Walmart, rolling back DEI initiatives after leaning in just a few years ago. So, yeah.
Story number two, the birds. Yeah, we're still talking about them. The championship glow lingers.
And we're going to be talking about them, okay?
We're going to just bear with us for a few more days, folks. Funny roundup in the Inquirer about all the stuff that Kansas City now owes Philadelphia as a result of various Super Bowl bets. For instance, KCUR, our sister station in Kansas City, owes us some barbecue. Did you know that?
I did not know. And I love barbecue. Yeah. Y'all need to send that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Could you overnight that, KCUR? We're hungry over here.
And put some ice in there.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. Please.
Keep it fresh.
Don't send us rotten barbecue. I think that should have been clear from the get-go. No rotten barbecue. But also, we're getting barbecue from the governor of Missouri, mayor of Kansas City. The best one, the craziest one, the one that I couldn't even believe this bet was made because it's a very expensive bet. Kansas City's art museum is loaning the PMA an oil painting by Monet.
Whoa.
It's called the Croquet Party. Shipping art is not like a...
That's not cheap.
So see, it's not a trivial thing. We're actually getting a Monet, I think, for several months. You can go to the PMA and see this.
I'm going to do a Philly collar pop now.
Do that collar pop. I also had to imagine. I'd put myself in the mind of trying to explain to Monet himself why his painting is being shipped across the country because of a sport he's never heard of. Two cities, maybe he'd heard of Kansas City. I don't know, but maybe only... I guess he would have heard of Philadelphia and Kansas City, but just how bizarre all that would have been to him. So anyways, the bets are getting paid.
Yeah.
And we're getting some art.
That's good stuff. I'm going to have to go check it out.
I would love to check it out.
Yeah.
Also, some Eagles appeared on The Tonight Show.
They're blowing it. Look at, Philly's getting all the love. Go ahead.
It's a glow up week. And on The Tonight Show, quarterback Jalen Hurts and running back Saquon Barkley discussed one of the Eagles' signature plays. It is a quarterback sneak where the running back and often the tight end come from behind the quarterback to push Jalen Hurts forward. And with all that momentum, it's almost unstoppable if the Eagles only need a yard or two. Now, lots of people call this play the tush push, but the Eagles don't call it the tush push. Let's take a listen.
Jalen, you scored 3 touchdowns on Sunday. You did. The first one was doing what people are calling the tush push. Yeah. Is that what you call it?
It's not what I call it.
It's not what you call it.
It's not what I call it.
what do you call it?
I'm not going to say what I call it, but it's
okay, but it's not.
Everybody is came up with their own name for it. The brotherly shove, the tush push, all these different things. It's not that.
So they don't call the tush push, which leaves open the question of what do the Eagles call what we call the tush push?
Yeah.
What do you think? What do you think they call it, Jerry?
I have no idea, but I would call it. I have two options.
Hit me.
The Hurts hustle.
Okay. Not bad. Okay.
Or the Jalen Ram.
Oh, the Jalen Ram.
Yeah.
Just because he's ramming into the...
Yeah, yeah.
Is there more of a pun there than that?
I'm not that good at puns. I'm not the punny person here.
Okay.
But those are my options. What do you got?
First I'll credit our producer, Debbie Builder, who said, what about the rear advance?
That is actually pretty good.
That's not bad.
That's really good. Yeah, I like that.
So I'm pretty sure he wears number one.
He does. Hurts. He does.
He's a Philadelphia Eagle. You could call it Eagle One.
That's actually a pretty good football name.
That's a football name, right? That's more of a joke.
I had no attachment to the game at all. Just that's good. Eagle One.
Like you get in the huddle and say Eagle One. Eagle One.
That sounds like a flight, like a plane, a helicopter or something, some kind of military operation.
Something. And finally, what about Hut Hut Butt?
I feel like they wouldn't call it that. Something inside me says the Eagles wouldn't call it that, but they,
Well, maybe they have a sense of
humor.
But
it's funny, though.
Maybe they have a little sense of humor about it. You call it the tush push. We call it hut hut butt.
Yeah. I'll leave it there. I'll leave it there. Okay.
I didn't say
Eagles,
you could take it. Just leave
let
it.
Us know. Let us know.
Studio tubers in the chat. Let us know.
Let us know what you think about Hut Hut Butt. Okay.
No, or you could pitch your own name.
Yeah.
I do personally like the brotherly shove, by the way.
That is cool. I do like that one. So final story. Do we have time for
our
final story?
We okay. Have time. We always have time.
If you're into estate sales, there is a big one this weekend at the house formerly owned by boxing legend Muhammad Ali. The house is located in Overbrook along City Line Avenue. And look
West
at that. If you're on YouTube, you get to see. Ali lived in this 3-bedroom house in the early 1970s with his second wife, Belinda. There are pictures of him in an Ebony magazine from the time he lived in the house at the estate sale. Okay. And he, by the way, he moved to Cherry Hill, New Jersey in 1973. And at that time, he sold the house to Kobe Bryant's maternal grandparents, the Coxes, who owned it through his childhood and his Laker career. And Kobe's mom, Pamela, put the house on the market after her mom, Mildred Cox, died. And by the way, there's some cool items inside of the house that will be for sale on February 17th.
It's such a time capsule. Like, you really have to go
see it. Oh, my gosh. There, the bathroom has that mosaic tile bathtub. There's butterfly wallpaper. It's so cool. There's a YouTube video, by the way.
Oh, this is so, right now on the screen, if you're watching on YouTube, is my favorite one. It's this incredible bar setup where the bar itself is covered in this white leather, and there are these white leather bar stools.
And talk about the red carpet.
And the carpet underneath is like this red velvet look.
I mean, my goodness.
It looks like it's straight out of 1973. If I was going to buy anything at the estate sale, it would be those bar stools. My God, do they have swagger.
By the way, the house was listed on Redfin for $600,000. Looks like right now there's an offer pending for the house, but there's an outdoor pool, a gazebo area. You mentioned the bar. Such a cool house. I love thrifting and old stuff. So if I was around this weekend, I would totally just go look around, sit in a chair. Maybe
can I give you an idea?
Take some pictures for Instagram or something.
Can I give you an idea?
But it's pretty cool. Yeah.
You should become a YouTube content creator, and your first video should be you walking around this estate sale.
Ugh.
How good would that do on
YouTube? That probably would.
That would do numbers.
Yeah. Especially spending in one of those bar stools.
Yeah.
So cool.
Also, by the way, I feel like it doesn't get pointed out enough that Muhammad Ali lived in Overbrook and also Cherry Hill, New Jersey.
Yeah.
He's not really thought of as a Philly area guy, but he did live in the area for quite some time. Anyways, I just brought up YouTube.
Yes.
That was intentional because we're going to talk about YouTube today. And we're going to talk to a local content creator who has hundreds of thousands of subscribers. We're going to talk to a couple of academics who have chronicled the rise and will tell us about the future of YouTube. And we're getting your comments and your calls. 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. Or, yes, leave a comment on the YouTube stream. We'll be right back on Studio 2.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. 20 years ago, February 14th, 2005, three former PayPal employees registered a new domain name, YouTube.com. A couple months later, they uploaded the first video, and it's just a 19-second clip of founder Javed Karim at the San Diego Zoo.
All right, so here we are, one of the elephants. And the cool thing about these guys is that they have really, really, really long trunks, and that's cool. And that's pretty much all there is to say.
Just like that, from elephant trunks to global domination. Today, YouTube has 2.5 billion monthly users streaming content that ranges from funny cats and makeup tutorials to podcasts like Studio 2. I know. The past two decades have brought us several iconic moments, wild challenges, and people sharing a whole lot online. Take a look or listen to these viral videos and clips that represent what YouTube means to its billions of users.
So today, I'm going to do the onion challenge. This is the onion.
Daddy bit me. And that really hurt, John, and it's still hurting.
100 coats of glitter nail polish, which might get soured by the fact that I'm also doing 100 coats of spray tan on the same arm.
That's right. We are talking about foods that cause your urine to be smelly. And by the way, this does it for most people. If you don't think you get smelly urine after asparagus, I certainly want you to write in the comments.
Now, aside from all that content, a lot has happened since YouTube's conception. Questions about copyright infringement, misinformation, and users have grown with it, finding ways to monetize content. The possibilities are endless, so we want to take a closer look at YouTube and where it may be headed. We've got a great panel with us. Let me introduce all of you first. We have Bianca Zamora Perez, doctoral student researching AI and YouTube at the University of Pennsylvania. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Right next to Bianca is Andrew Iliadis, associate professor at the Lou Klein College of Media and Communication at Temple University. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And Dr. Jennifer Caudill, a practicing family physician and content creator on YouTube. Dr. Jen, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And you, our listeners at home and on YouTube, our question is, how has YouTube changed the way you use media? How has it changed our culture? You can call in 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. And for our studio tubers watching online, you can check us out by leaving your comment or question in the YouTube chat.
And I'm looking at the chat right now, and there's some folks chiming in with how they use YouTube. Mm-hmm. And it's fascinating, the diversity of the answers. So Sarah Thatcher says, professionally, I use YouTube just about every day as a French and Spanish teacher. I find all kinds of videos on everything from vocab and grammar to authentic materials. Then the Hawkins says, I've been using YouTube for a couple years now to learn game development skills. There's a large community of programmers. And then Judy Bennett's on YouTube, live streaming Senate hearings. I mean, those three things have almost nothing in common except that they are video content. So, Andrew, take us back to the beginning.
To the very beginning.
To the very beginning. What separated this little website, YouTube.com, from its competitors?
Well, before YouTube, you know, there were a lot of streaming services, things like Real Player, QuickTime Player, Windows Media Player.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of them were really kind of like grainy, though. They didn't really perform very well. It was difficult to like get a clear picture. But I think primarily they weren't monetized, so people weren't incentivized to share as much with those videos. So with YouTube, you all of a sudden you see this explosion of user content, better technology, monetization, and then it kind of took off after 2007.
So the ability, so the incentive for people to share was stronger on YouTube than it was on other platforms.
I think so. I think also one thing we should remember is the iPhone came out roughly in 2007 with video capability in 2009. And so I think the history of YouTube should also be told along with the history of the iPhone as well, and how easy it was for people to take video and upload it too.
So right time, right place,
yeah,
as well. Mm-hmm. And then, Bianca, do you identify over the years certain things that YouTube did to further spur its growth? Like, it's nice to have a good start, but we've seen so many, you know, dot-com companies that had a nice start and then whoop, fell off. Were there other things that happened along the way that made YouTube a behemoth?
Yeah, so YouTube is like uniquely positioned to align itself with creators, and it has a few different programs like the YouTube Partner Program, which right now I think has about 3 million creators. And that program is supposed to help creators create content in every genre, whether it be makeup videos, ASMR videos, popular culture videos. And they give them resources. For example, Content ID is an algorithm that runs across YouTube and will take down videos if there's a copyright infringement. For example, like say I post a video online and it has my favorite song, but that song is copyrighted. If I'm a YouTube partner program, I will actually get like more resources than a regular creator would to get that resolved, to get that video monetized after it is taken down. That has caused a little bit of problems, though, because that means that some creators are disadvantaged while other creators get more privileges.
It's not as egalitarian maybe as it once was.
Yeah.
No.
And I wanted to kind of pop in here and just talk about the fact that YouTube has tried on multiple occasions to sort of create its own content, but has sort of pivoted back to being user-generated content focused. Mm-hmm. How has that been a game changer for YouTube, or has kept it growing? And you know, Andrew, I think you can probably speak to that.
Yeah, well, I mean, probably the big thing is like looking at the data that's being generated from all these users. Like YouTube has really rich metadata about what's working, what's popular, what's making money. And so, you know, a lot of the YouTube videos that were posted were like highly sensational, roughly around 2013 up to 2015. And so YouTube would have been looking at a lot of this data and saying, hey, this stuff works, this doesn't work. And then, of course, you have Netflix coming up, right? And they have a competitor with that. And so YouTube probably realized that, you know, we have a specific niche in the market, right? And so they might want to focus on user-generated videos rather than competing with somebody like Netflix.
Yeah, and I want to bring in a caller before we bring Dr. Jen into this conversation, because we have questions for you as well. We have Maggie, who is a content creator from Baltimore, on the line. Maggie, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi, thank you so much for having me. I just wanted to say that YouTube has very seriously changed my life. I have about 500,000 subscribers on my channel, Refashioned Hippie. And what I'm able to talk about is comparing high fashion, very valuable luxury pieces. What I love to do is compare it to local charities, because I find it ludicrous that people will spend like $43,000 on a skirt. So I love being able to show off organizations like Heifer International and just compare what you could have done with that money.
Wow.
And I've been able to gather such a wonderful community just being a stay-at-home mom in Maryland. But my community has fully funded 4 GoFundMe so far. We've highlighted some amazing small businesses, and YouTube has given me this platform that I never could have dreamed of.
Wow. Thank you, Maggie, content creator from Baltimore, calling into the show. We really appreciate that. And Dr. Jen, you're a content creator, a practicing family physician who has found wild success on YouTube. Just tell us about your journey in getting into content creation and sort of growing your following. You have almost 350,000 subscribers to your channel.
Yeah, for YouTube, I do. And it's good to see you, Cherry.
Nice to see you, too. We go way back to
I was doing CBS Philly every couple of weeks for years. Yeah, so I'm a practicing family physician. I'm an associate professor at Rowan University. And I was doing TV before social media. I know you know this, and that's my journey. I used YouTube as a way to upload the TV segments I was doing, whether it was on the Today Show or whatever, the ones that would allow me to post them. And I really didn't think much about social media other than as a platform to put the TV segments that I was on. What changed for me was the pandemic. You know, I think I had maybe 13,000 Facebook page subscribers going into the pandemic. By the way, people think that you get social media subscribers by being on TV, and you do not. That TV doesn't bring you social media subscribers. But going into the pandemic, it was the first time I started making my own content. You know, there was all these myths going around. Black people can't get COVID is a myth.
That so much one. Misinformation.
Misinformation, disinformation. Yeah. Can you get packages from Amazon? All sorts of stuff people were wondering about. And I was doing all of this TV, but the myths were outpacing. The misinformation was outpacing the solid information. So I actually just picked up my phone and started making videos as a way to try to answer in real time questions people were asking.
So you were like being a doctor, just trying to inform people.
Yeah, it really was, you know, besides doing the TV stuff, it was like, wait, I just heard this on the street. Let me tell you all, this XYZ is not true. What happened was some of the segments went viral into the millions on Facebook, and I didn't even understand. I was like, what is happening?
You're like, why?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't even understand that. So really, it was 2020, even though I came in with Instagram and whatever, I have about 1.7 million across all platforms. But I came in with a very small fraction of that. But my social media following grew really because of content that I started making in response to people's questions, et cetera. So that's really my history into this.
And what do you think the biggest lesson as a content creator that you learned in just sort of like figuring out what the people want, what the masses want?
Yeah, you know, I think that social media, as Maggie, the caller who just called in, she's obviously doing a lot for good, right? There's a lot of space to do good with social media. And for those who have a message, my fellow panelists, for anyone out there who has a skill, who wants to teach something, who has a message, who wants to change the world, these are platforms that you can really do that with. Of course, there's always two sides to every coin, but I'm focusing on the good, right? Which and that's my message to people out there is that, you know, even if you're like the most niched physician and you deal with one small part, say, of the brain, There's education you can provide to people. There's value you can add to the world. Even if you're a car mechanic and you love dealing with something with a car, there's value added in what you can share. That's what I've learned. And I underestimated. I did not understand that. I do now.
Wow.
How did you come to understand what works and what tends to hook people on YouTube and allow you to grow that community? Like, because it sounds like initially you were surprised, and then presumably you started to reverse engineer this thing and realize, okay, so then how do I design something
right
that the algorithm and the community wants?
Right. So that was the next step, was then how do I maximize this and how do I keep this going? So I do a few things. You mentioned the YouTube Creators Program. I'm in that. I'm also in I have a Facebook Partner Manager and other things. So yes, they provide resources and things like that. But we have to remember, and this is not my generation, but YouTube now is a search engine, essentially.
Yep.
It is where people go to learn how to tie a tie. My generation, we want to read how to tie a tie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is a presumption, but I feel like people now want to watch how to tie a tie.
And 100%.
So when people, right. Yeah. So when people want to learn something, they use YouTube as a search engine. So I had to train my thinking and to think, what are people searching for?
Yeah.
Because it's a search engine, right? And of course, it's intimately linked with Google. So I use things like Google Trends. I use I look at other videos that are doing well in terms of health topics. And yes, I have this short list of medical topics. I won't go into it, but short list of things I know will always do well because they just do.
And I want to play this video, and this is probably one of your most watched videos. Uh-oh. And you probably know which one it is.
Lord.
I got to play it. I got to play it, Dr. Jen, because I watched the whole thing.
Yeah.
Okay. And take a look at this video and take a listen if you're on the radio at this video with Dr. Jen. Go right ahead.
If you don't use it, will you lose it? I'm talking about sexual intercourse and your vagina. So many of you guys have asked me. You said, Dr. Jen, I don't have sex often. I haven't had sex for a long time, et cetera, whatever the situation might be. If I don't use my vagina in this way for a long time, could I lose it, you ask? And that's a really great question.
And you go into it answering a lot of user questions, yes, listener questions. Mm-hmm. 10 million views on that.
Yeah.
Did you have any idea it would get 10 million views when you created it?
No, but I knew that it was the only reason I created it was people kept asking me about it. That's the other way that I find content. It's not just Google Trends and stuff like that. I read the comments. They always say, don't read the comments, because that's how you find out what people think and what they want to know and what they're wondering about.
This constant feedback you're getting.
It's constant feedback. Yeah. And what I found in other videos, they'd be like, well, I haven't had sex in a long time. What happens? And I first a few times I read that, I'm like, I kept reading that question over and over. I'm like, doggone it. These folks want to know what the answer is.
But you know what's interesting?
I made a video.
You made a video about it.
But what I take away from that is that there's this whole category of things that are probably considered too taboo to discuss on quote-unquote mainstream media.
And you don't even want to ask your doctor.
And content creators have filled the vacuum. Yeah. So I guess the question that I ask to you, Andrew Iliadis, is how has this reshaped media, reshaped society? I mean, it's a big question, but we have to ask it because this is billions of people getting information this way.
I mean, it's in a big way. We all know, especially, you know, from the last election, look at what the current president did, right? They went on a media blitz on like famous YouTuber and podcast channels, and because he kind of knew, like, I don't need to go to this mainstream media anymore. I'm going to go to like all these, you know, comedian podcasters. And so it's shifting the landscape in a big way, right? A lot of our elected officials are going on these podcasts. There's, you know, misinformation being spread, as you said, on YouTube. YouTube has had to increase certain measures to make sure that there's like content labels or warnings happening now. Mm-hmm. Although we probably all heard what's happening with Meta, that they're getting rid of their fact checking and things like that. You know, YouTube has like, we'll have a Wikipedia box underneath like a video about the Holocaust, or we'll have like a CDC link underneath a video about vaccines, or I've seen ones from the UN. And so, you know, it's good that we have these safeguards appearing, right? Things are changing, but I feel like we might start heading back into a kind of darker direction if they start getting rid of things like fact-checking. Because so many, as you said, young people are treating YouTube as a search engine, things like TikTok and YouTube.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And Bianca, if you could talk about the algorithm, because one thing about YouTube, it's a slippery slope. And I have young nephews and nieces. They start watching and you look up and it's been an hour and a half and they've been watching YouTube videos back to back.
It's just feeding.
Yeah, it's just feeding them videos. So how does this algorithm work to sort of keep you engaged on the platform?
Well, the algorithm's constantly changing. There's a lot of discussion on whether or not YouTube should make this algorithm more transparent because there are like dark patterns in like little loops that you can go into. For example, say you start watching makeup videos and you are really interested into those. And it happens both with shorts and like traditional YouTube content. So I think it's important to understand that the algorithm is now not only looking at what you're watching on like the everyday, like what you listen to the podcast in the morning. It's also knowing like the little bits in between, like what you're interested in, like on your work break, you know, stuff like that. But if you think about like young kids, especially, they'll start watching makeup videos and then maybe an hour later start getting recommended like dieting videos. And then once they start getting recommended dieting videos, they might find one creator who's maybe promoting a way of eating that is not healthy. And that's how we get into like very dangerous situations, because there is no way for someone to tell a child, a minor, or even an adult too, that you are now following a path. And I think YouTube had fixed this a little bit, because back before, they had a lot of violations of content being promoted from like terrorist organizations, which got YouTube into a lot of controversy. But after that, I think they changed it and now they promote more happy content. Mm. But I still think that those dark patterns are there, because if you think about what's engaging is not necessarily what's the best for people. So if we're thinking
about YouTube itself, you mentioned that they made a change around content promoted by terrorist organizations. But I also wonder, in a different categorical way, have they shifted what they want you to see? Like, I don't remember 10 years ago people watching podcasts on YouTube.
Podcasts 10 years ago?
They were
starting there, yeah, but they've blown up. Yeah, but you're right.
Andrew, you're saying you're doing this.
They started prioritizing like long form content. I think we all like know that, right? So
it started with like stuff that felt more like vines, and now it's the algorithm like stuff that keeps you there for a long time.
Yeah, in 2012, they changed the algorithm to favor watch time as opposed to views. I mean, views are obviously still important, but watch time is also very important. So that's when you start seeing these one-hour podcasts, two-hour podcasts, Joe Rogan, stuff like that,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. The stickiness of it. Yeah.
And Dr. Jen, mm-hmm. how have you seen, like, yeah. just in the years that you've been really focused on YouTube, how have you seen it shift and impact your views?
It's hard for me to say because, you know, even though I've been on YouTube technically since maybe 2012 or 13, again, I wasn't really active until the last 5 years.
Yeah. So how have you seen a shift in the last five?
I'm honestly not sure, right? So my perspective is very limited. I'm in the Partner Creator Program, and I got into that relatively quickly after starting posting. My view is relatively limited. I know what they tell me as part of the Partner Creator Program. I know what they tell us, how the algorithm works, right? There's a lot of theories about the algorithm, and people do videos about the algorithm. Then YouTube has their statements about actually how the algorithm works. I mean, I'm sort of not answering your question, but this is my answer is...
But that's real, though.
That's real. You
that's
don't
what
know.
Bianca yeah, right. It's talking very about limited. Is it's a black box in some ways.
You mean the algorithm?
The algorithm.
Well, I don't know that I don't know that I feel that way.
You don't feel that way.
What I feel like is I know what they tell me, because they've got videos and they have videos right. for the public to see, and they talk, because it's probably one of the most, you know, people, they think this algorithm is like some black hole. It's like this, you know. What it might be, I don't know. What I'm saying though is they've done videos on it. So what I know is what they've said. Do I have an opinion about that versus what actually is happening? I don't. I don't have enough knowledge to know if that, you know, that's all I know. Does that make sense?
You try to work the system as much as you can.
Well, I know what they tell me.
Yeah.
There's also YouTube Shorts now. So although there was the long form stickiness, they are competing with TikTok and Instagram Reels now. And so they have
So the YouTube, pendulum goes back and forth.
Kind of, or they're trying to capture both
they're
of those
trying to get
things,
other people.
Right?
They don't want people to just leave them because they don't do short form content.
Interesting.
So, and you've done both, yeah.
Exactly. So they started investing a lot in this long form stuff. Now they're seeing TikTok and saying, wait a second, let us also try to grab that market as well. Yeah. Fascinating. We're going to talk a lot more about YouTube on the other side of this break.
Yes.
Some great YouTube comments I want to read on the other side of this break. I want to talk about the future of the platform. Studio2@whyy.org is our email. 888-477-9499 is our number. Stick with us on Studio 2. And welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg, and we are talking about 20 years of video streaming on YouTube. The platform has grown to a global media entity with more than 2 billion users every month. And with us today to talk about YouTube are Bianca Zamora-Perez, a doctoral student researching AI and YouTube at Annenberg at the University of Pennsylvania. We also have Dr. Jennifer Caudill, a family medicine physician who's practicing and a content creator on YouTube. We also have Andrew Iliadis, associate professor at the Lou Klein College of Media and Communications at Temple University.
And our question for you, how has YouTube changed the way that you use media? How has it changed our culture? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org or leave us a comment on the YouTube chat. And the Matt Leiden Project says, I've made a few videos, mostly finger puppet stuff for my own boredom cures. Mostly, I use it as music in the background while doing art and writing. I'm right there with you.
Yeah.
The music, you can really get sucked down the music rabbit hole on YouTube. Bro's a fan. Shirley says, another cool thing on YouTube is the vintage content. I also love that. Mm-hmm. I love watching educational films from the 40s, 50s, and 60s. Oh. Great dating advice. And then she has the laughing emoji. I wanted to add, Beth also had an email about the DIY movement and learning how to do things on YouTube and how that has helped the platform grow. Andrew or Bianca, do you have thoughts on that? Because it does feel like that has been a big part of the success story for YouTube.
I'll just quickly add to something you said, which is people really do, especially young people, treat it like a search engine now. And so anything that has to do with instruction or education, that's one of their main categories that they have. If you look at some of the most highly rated channels, it's like science channels, learning how to do things like that. But yeah.
Well, my research actually focuses a little bit more on AI, but that very reason of all of these diverse content, whether it be like tutorials like how to make a craft, or maybe it's how to find the slope of a line, or maybe it's an MIT course because you're in college and you need to learn something. Those are a lot of diverse contents that you wouldn't be able to get just from one website, but YouTube has it all compiled in one space. What is really interesting in an age of generative AI is that a lot of Gen AI companies saw this as like essentially a gold mine for training models. But what's really particularly interesting about YouTube is this is all video content. So it's not going to be able, like, how can you make a video be ChatGPT, right? Well, if we go back to 2022 in November when OpenAI released the first iteration of ChatGPT, they were kind of racing after all of the other tech companies found out they made this great model and that everyone loved it. They wanted to make another one, and they wanted to make it better. We now have that model, and it's called ChatGPT 4.0. But when they were making it, they realized they had already consumed all of the data online. That means all of the text data on Reddit, all of the news on The Atlantic. So they needed a new space. Where could they go? They went to YouTube because they had all of this instructional content, not only like educational, but also like how to fix a CV, how to be professional, also how to tell a good joke, how to be a good friend. These are all like how to be healthy. These are different
things. It's like advice on how to be human.
Yeah.
Which is great if you're a ChatGPT.
Yes. But the problem is if it's all video content, OpenAI needed a way to transcribe this. So what did they do? They created an algorithm called Whisper. And the New York Times just released in August 2024 a crazy investigative piece where it traces how OpenAI created Whisper. So to translate or transcribe these YouTube videos into text data, that data was then fed into large language models that created the generation of chatbots that we have today, like ChatGPT 4.0. OpenAI had a luxurious entryway by making this Whisper model to transcribe these videos, and it's essentially just an algorithm, and I'm pretty sure Greg Brockman, which is the president right now, was helping on that project.
But so ChatGPT, OpenAI devoured all of YouTube? and has used
YouTube to train its chatbots, is what you're telling us.
Oh, not only OpenAI and ChatGPT, it's also, they created their own algorithm named Whisper to transcribe these videos, but Apple Intelligence also did this. But they had a backdoor because they couldn't actually get all of this content on their own. They didn't have their own algorithm to transcribe this in mass. So what did they do? They went to a lot of YouTube creators who had already transcribed their videos by hand. And you may be wondering, why do YouTube videos, or why do they have transcriptions? A lot of YouTube creators make transcriptions for their videos so that people with hearing inabilities or like hearing impairments can access these videos.
Yeah, and it seems to me that YouTube has become this, just by happenstance and it being user generated, has become this place where it's sort of pushing the envelope and has set up a great space for, you know, AI to kind of push things forward. And we want to talk about the future of YouTube a little bit. I want to read a couple comments. Victor says, I use YouTube for one of two things, listening to live versions of songs that I like so I can see how the performances adapt the songs for live shows, and then occasional tutorials on how to fix something because I'm useless in the household fixes department. Like you said, Bianca.
Amen.
To Ray comments, I go to YouTube University for a lot of DIY things.
Yep.
Beth says, I think YouTube has a huge impact on the do-it-yourself movement and empowered people to tackle projects that they wouldn't have otherwise thought they were capable of. My partner actually used YouTube to figure out how to clear the gutters. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can use YouTube for anything. So I want to talk about this sort of cultural phenomenon because everybody has become, I mean, Dr. Jane, you are an actual expert. You are a medical doctor and all that. But people have become like, where people want to share information and teach other people. How has that sort of changed the cultural aspects, you know, just because we now have platforms like YouTube and social media generally, where we can have those types of conversations, Andrew?
I mean, the DIY part's great, right? Everyone should be able to look and figure out how to tie a tie or do those things. But I think along with that, there's a certain like flattening of information, which has led to like the erosion of expertise a little bit, right? Like I have
everyone's an expert.
Yeah.
Everyone's an expert. I have an extended family member who thinks that, you know, a YouTube video is the same thing as like a blind peer reviewed academic study. And, you know, to this person, you know, that information, they can't, you know, figure out whether one is more, you know, based on expertise or if one's fake. And so it's great that we have DIY. You know, I used YouTube a few weeks ago to learn how to do another tie, you know, tie my tie in a different way. But at the same time, you're seeing the rise of all of these kind of like, you know, kind of nefarious accounts that are sharing disinformation.
Or even if it was just someone, because there's the political angle, of course, and that's the part we talk about all the time. But even if it's someone claiming to be an expert on rewiring your house, but they really don't know what they're doing.
Ooh, you know, Lord.
That's dangerous, right? Like, you know, you have to know. So what does YouTube actually vet and flag and disallow? Like, what are their parameters? What's allowed and what is explicitly not allowed?
Well, you can probably speak more to like the AI capturing things like child exploitation. They use AI to catch things like child exploitation, right? That kind of stuff. But like I said earlier, the things they tend to focus on, you know, Holocaust videos, they will put a warning underneath, like a Wikipedia summary. Said earlier, the CDC links related to vaccines. I've seen UN information. But you're right, it's like, where's the line? Like, where do they put these fact check boxes and where don't they? What topics deserve a fact check? And I think we're going to start to see, as I said earlier, the erosion of that kind of thing. So we might be heading into an era of more junk, you know, junk science kind of on the platform.
As a physician, I mean, we are in that space of junk science. One of the reasons why I continue to do the videos I do is because I realize that we as physicians, it's not good enough for us just to be in the office. We actually have to be out here fighting all the misinformation. And there are a lot of people who are doctors, but don't say that what they're a doctor of.
Yeah.
And sometimes when you find out what they're a doctor of, you realize they have no business probably talking about health. One thing YouTube has done is they've started for certain healthcare professionals, like I have a, and it's not just me, it's other healthcare professionals, but they have a tag that says this information is from a licensed medical physician in the United States, blah, 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 blah. So that's something. And I remember when they were rolling this out, there were meetings about this and, you know, for not just physicians, but other healthcare professionals that were licensed and certified. You had to submit your credentials, yeah, et cetera, and you get this tag. The misinformation is, from a health standpoint, is dangerous. And that's actually one of the reasons why I still do what I do, is because there are too many people out there saying really stuff that's utterly, that's dangerous. And as you mentioned, you know, a lot of people say, well, I'm going to do my own research. And I respect and understand that phrase. The problem is if you don't have the skill set or the knowledge set to be able to distinguish between the research you were evaluating. And conversations yesterday in the office with a patient, well, I've seen and I've heard some things. Well, where are they from? And so I just my caution out there, this is also a public service announcement, because this is, I used to be that as a family doctor, the only things I would have to try to convince people of was to get the flu shot and that it didn't cause a flu. Now I have to convince you that metformin is not going to do this to you, that statins won't blow up your liver, that, I mean, in terms of the misinformation and the skepticism about things, it's everything now.
Yeah.
And I appreciate people, being invested in their health. That's not what I'm saying. But it's where you get the information and who is saying the information and whether it's actually correct and appropriate and in the right context for you. So that's, again, soapbox, but, I do hope people hear that.
Does YouTube have any avenues to sort of flag stuff like this? Because you have a Dr. Jen who's a licensed physician. She's a practicing physician giving you good information. But then you have other people who are giving false information that could cause, it could get somebody really ill or hurt.
It does all the time.
Yeah. There's real harm being done here.
Absolutely. I see it in the office all the time. But to your question, I don't know other than what I've mentioned.
Well, like channels get demonetized all the time, and kind of like with Twitter, a while back there was a lot of accounts that got taken off of Twitter. There were people that were demonetized, taken off of YouTube. What do we see now? We see a lot of those accounts from X popping back up again. And I'm scared the same thing might start happening as you see these social media companies kind of like turn the ship in this other direction. They might reinstate some of these channels. And so I think media literacy, what you're talking about, is very important. And that's what we try to do with our first and second year students at Temple, is try to teach them media literacy, right? What is information? What's the source? What are the credentials? Yeah. Things like that.
Bianca, is a lot of this flacking done with AI technology? I can't imagine there's humans going through billions of videos and being like, that doesn't sound right.
Yeah, who does that?
is it? What are the mechanisms that they're using? Do you know?
So there are algorithms that go through and flag all of the content that goes before you upload a video. There's like a little screen that lets your video upload, and while it's uploading, it'll run if it was like violating copyright, if it's violating terms of service. And usually under terms of service, there are like dangerous content that is misinformation. But the problem is that there's 500 hours of like YouTube content uploaded every minute. So the sheer velocity, and that statistic has been out for a while, but the sheer velocity of content coming out is at a pace that I do not understand how we would possibly limit it. At the same time, I have seen a lot, just in my personal experience, a lot of like circumventing the privacy or terms of service or misinformation. So for example, like say you're spreading misinformation, you wouldn't want that video to get demonetized because it's both going to get a lot of views and a lot of like engagement and therefore ads. So you would get more money. But they would maybe change the title a little bit so it doesn't go as, it's not as flagrant. It's not as obvious that this is misinformation or that this is triggering content or that this would put someone at risk.
Yeah.
And they would put like little emojis or something small that would kind of change the title so that it doesn't necessarily look like this is harmful content. So I'm seeing this
people
a lot.
People can Trojan horse this, basically, is what you're saying.
Yes. And another problem is, especially on podcasts, like if someone's talking, for example, like Joe Rogan, if someone's talking for 2 hours, how are they going to know like at 1 hour and two at 1 hour and 2 minutes that they said one sentence that was misinformation?
Yeah, it's such a vexing problem. Real quick though, but we do have to wrap this up. I would love to get just a real quick thought from you, Bianca, on where YouTube is heading next as it tries to continue to grow its footprint. Mm-hmm. Like how YouTube might evolve over the next 5-10 years.
Yeah. So I just looked at the YouTube 2025 year for, they usually release these press releases so that they can let the public creators know what's happening for the year to come. And this year, they're really trying to push YouTube as an intersection of streaming, short form content, but also traditional TV by incorporating partnerships with like Warner Brothers. They recently just released a playlist with 31 movies that were from Warner Brothers. A lot of them were very quirky.
It sounds like they want to do basically everything.
Oh, yes.
It's like
all YouTube video TV. Content. Yeah.
Exactly. Yes. Like literally anything that you would watch with your eyeballs or maybe even listen to with your ears is
YouTube.
YouTube's going to be the place. Wow. I mean, that is fascinating and maybe a little scary.
Yeah. And Dr. Jen, as you look forward, what are you thinking about as a content creator? Are you going to try to continue to grow? Like, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, no, for me, I mean, it's important. It's a mission. It's more than just, I do this because I feel it's needed. There's too much misinformation. I see it in the office every day, people telling me stuff they heard or they saw. And so I feel like it's a personal mission to be out there saying what is true and trying to help other people.
You've got to be in the arena.
I feel like all doctors do. And then the last thing I'll say very quickly is that we were talking about like DIY stuff. One thing I notice over time is that, my videos in the beginning start out being like, well, you know, what is multiple sclerosis? What are the symptoms? Or what is it? Why do sore throats happen? No, people want to know how to fix a sore throat. People want to know how to fix a cough.
Some remedies.
The DIY. Yeah. So a lot of my content, as it's changed and growing, like the video I posted today on Instagram was, you know, the best home remedies for sore throat. And those things do exist and they're evidence-based. But people, again, people want to take ownership of their lives and health. I'm a fan of that. So giving people sort of safe, healthy, evidence-based ways to manage their health on the best
service
way
journalism
the
is really what it is.
DIY health. I love it.
So I want to thank all of you. Dr. Jen Caudill, practicing family physician, content creator on YouTube. Thank you so much for your time.
Absolutely.
Andrew Iliadis, associate professor at the Lou Klein College of Media and Communication at Temple. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Bianca Zamora Perez, doctoral student researching AI and YouTube at Penn. Thank you so much for your time. And on the topic of AI, I do have to say we have an event at Princeton on the 27th all about the future of AI. So we'll maybe even talk about YouTube there. WHYY.org/events to register.
Yes, we hope to see you there. And by the way, thank you to our producers, Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Mike Schiffler, thanks for being our visual producer. Al Banks and Tina Calique engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory from Studio 2. Here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.